expected. NPR's Steve Henn has this report.
Apple brought in $35 billion in revenue, but the company still managed to disappoint Wall Street analysts like Walter Piecyk at BTIG.
Apple missed on iPhones. They only sold 26 million. The street was expecting much more.
Most of Apple's profits come from the iPhone, and Apple CEO Tim Cook told investors widespread rumors Apple will release a new phone in the fall may have depressed sales.
You know, I'm glad that people want the next thing. I'm super happy about it.
But that wasn't Apple's only problem. Cook said the sluggish global economy, especially in Europe, took a toll too.
France and Greece and Italy were particularly poor.
Yeah, I think in generally consumers in Europe are getting pickier.
Carolina Milanese is a vice president at Gartner Research.
They're more demanding. They're trying to get the best for their money.
To make things worse, Walter Piecyk says big telecom companies all over the world are tired of subsidizing customers who want the newest iPhone.
The change here is that guys like AT&T, when you go back to them after a year and say, give me a subsidized phone, they're saying no. Wait another 10 months or pay us $600.
And Piecyk says in this economy, that could take a big bite out of Apple's future sales. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
While we may be suffering through a drought, one of the advantages of a lack of consistent thunderstorms is a lack of power outages due to downed trees falling on power lines. Millions of people lost power in a storm that hit the mid-Atlantic states last month, and a lot of those outages were traced to trees knocking lines down. Utility companies, in response, are aggressively cutting down trees near electrical lines, but not everyone's happy about it. Sasha Pfeiffer of NPR member station WBUR explains.
There's a strange sight rolling through Boston's suburbs lately. It's called a brontosaurus, and it's a massive tree-cutting machine. The brontosaurus has a long mechanical arm with a clawed blade at the end. It can gobble up and take down a 60-foot tree in just seconds, like a dinosaur devouring its prey. Crews with the largest utility system in New England are using it to clear trees near many of its power lines in Massachusetts. Meg McConnell, who lives in the town of Wayland, looks on with shock as trees bordering driveways, even on private property, are targeted for removal.
I wept this morning, leaving my house. God, this looks awful.
The utility calls this a vegetation management program. Similar tree cutting by other power providers is happening around the country. And many residents are upset over what they say is a drastic change in utility companies' approach to tree maintenance.
Is this overkill? I think so.
Tom Conroy is a Massachusetts legislator who wants changes. The local utility, NSTAR, used to keep a buffer zone of trees around its high voltage lines, but is now clearing much more, its entire 250-foot right-of-way. Some land bordering the power lines has been stripped almost bare, a scorched earth policy, one resident called it. Again, Representative Conroy.
Are they being overzealous in terms of taking their legal rights and the easement they have to its nth degree? Yes, I think they're going too far.
Utility companies are certainly going farther than they used to. Before 2003, they were more lax about tree trimming. But then a tree that hit a major power line in Ohio contributed to a blackout affecting 55 million people in the Northeast and Canada.
That was a huge issue for the industry and a turning point.
Nathan Mitchell is with the American Public Power Association, which represents the country's community-owned utilities. He says after that incident, federal regulators put new guidelines in place for more extensive cutting near overhead wires. And while the feds didn't used to have much enforcement power, Mitchell says now they do.
They have fines that are up to $1 million a day.
So there's real incentive for utilities to cut, cut, cut. So far, power companies from Tennessee to Kansas to California all have been hit with six-figure fines. The Edison Electric Institute is a national trade association for investor-owned utilities. Spokesman Jim Owens says there's a constant, contentious push and pull between utilities and their customers who like their tree-lined neighborhoods but also want reliable power.
Obviously, no one wants to have their lovely trees trimmed, but we are required to do that vegetation management. And, of course, when we don't do it properly, bad things can happen.
And he only half jokes that in today's technology-soaked world, people lose their patience being without electricity.
When your iPhone battery goes down and you can't charge it.
Back in Wayland, Massachusetts, resident Robert Noah wishes the utilities would cut more selectively or just lop the tops off trees like they used to. Instead, He believes many power companies have decided that having no trees is the best vegetation management policy of all.
Well, I think there is a neighbors be damned, let's look at the dollars and cents aspect of what we're doing here. They can come in, they can clear cut, and they can effectively forget about us for the next three decades.
But utility companies say taking down trees entirely is the only way to guarantee no large-scale outages. And as each new storm topples more trees, they get even more vigilant. For NPR News, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in Boston.
Archery, badminton, fencing. They're just a few of the sports that, well, let's face it, we don't pay a darn bit of attention to except when the Olympics roll around. Commentator Frank DeFord says it's time to wake up, cheer, and redevelop our temporary quadrennial fascinations with sports that are undeniably obscure.
Why do we like the Olympics? Or, if somebody hadn't thought to start them up again 116 years ago, would ESPN have invented them to fill in summer programming? I'm not being cranky. It's just so odd that most of the most popular Olympic sports are the groundhog games. Swimming, gymnastics, and track and field come out every 4 years, see their shadow, and go right back underground where nobody pays any attention to them for another 4 years. Can you even name a gymnast? The Olympics are like an independent movie with foreign actors that you've never heard of. Especially since air travel came in, most sports have their own world championships. The world's athletes don't have to all come together in a smorgasbord every 4 years anymore. The soccer people are smart. They don't want the Olympics to horn in on their World Cup, so they pretty much limit the men's Olympic rosters to players aged 23 and under, which means that the Olympics are like a junior varsity soccer championship. Wisely, the NBA wants to institute the same kind of rules for basketball. If you make the Olympics a JV tournament, basketball's own world championship becomes much more valuable. But then the most upside-down thing about the Olympic Games is that the night they don't play any games at all gets the biggest audience. More people want to watch the competitors from Paraguay and Slovenia just amble around the track in their business casual clothes than want to watch Mr. Phelps in his swim trunks. It's like if the red carpet at the Academy Awards got a larger audience than when they actually opened up the Oscar envelopes. Simply, the Olympics are just not like any other big-time sports stuff. At the Olympics, athletes talk about wanting to medal, which is the verb that means third place. In every other competition, the ghost of Vince Lombardi lives on, and winning is everything. I guess at the end of the day, we like the Olympics precisely because they are so different. Dare I actually say it? The Olympics are kind of, sort of innocent. Emphasis on the kind of, sort of. But still, sometimes in the middle of the summer, it's just good enough to take a break and watch a quaint hokey ceremony and then cheer for people you never heard of in a sport you don't care about just because. Well, just because. And best of all, vis-a-vis the United States, the Summer Olympics are always scheduled in our election year, which gives us 2 weeks off from the eternal campaign. Just think, if it wasn't for the Olympics, now you'd be hearing all about Rob Portman or Tim Pawlenty. Instead, you'll be hearing about Jordan Weber. Who? Now you know a gymnast. Let the opening ceremony begin.
The comments of Frank DeFord. He comes to us from NPR member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. His latest book is a memoir called Over Time, My Life as a Sports Writer.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Blood donations decrease during the summer months, but patient need remains the same year-round. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is at 367-2202.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 25th of July, 2012. It was on this day, 1897, that Jack London, 21, sailed from San Francisco on his way to the Klondike to search for gold. He was on board the SS Umatilla with his brother-in-law, James Shepherd, who was close to 70. He had mortgaged his house to pay for the passage and gear for the two men. They had an 8-day trip from San Francisco to Juneau, Alaska, and then took boats to the start of the Chilkoot Trail, which was a tough journey, 33 miles through the Chilkoot Pass, the most direct route from the coast of Alaska to the Yukon. When the brother-in-law, James Shepherd, saw the Chilkoot Pass, he realized there was no way he could make it. He gave all of his gear to Jack London, and he went back to California. The Chilkoot Pass was brutal. The trail rose 1,000 feet in a half mile. He had to carry all their gear on their backs. It was too steep for animals. Jack London made it over the pass with a ton of gear, spent a hard winter on Lake Lindeman, came down with scurvy for lack of vegetables, and he headed back. Got back to San Francisco sick and depressed, but he started writing about his trip to the Yukon. Wrote a story for the Atlantic Monthly, An Odyssey of the North, which led to his book, The Call of the Wild, which made his career. Here's a poem for today by Mae Sarton, entitled In Texas. In Texas, the lid blew off the sky a long time ago, so there's nothing to keep the wind from blowing, and it blows all the time. Everywhere is far to go, so there's no hurry at all and no reason for going. In Texas, there's so much space, words have a way of getting lost in the silence before they're spoken, so people hang on a long time to what they have to say. And when they say it, the silence is not broken, but it absorbs the words and slowly gives them over to miles of white gold plains and gray-green hills, and they are part of that silence that outlives them. Nothing moves fast in Texas except the windmills and the hawk that rises up with a clatter of wings. Nothing more startling here than sudden motion. Everything is so still. But the earth slowly swings in time like a great swelling, never-ending ocean, and the houses that ride the tawny waves get smaller as you get near them, because you see them then under the whole sky, and the whole sky is so much taller with the lid off than a million towers built by men. After a while, you can only see what's at horizon's edge, and you are stretched with looking so far instead of near. So you jump. You were startled by a blown piece of sedge. You feel wide-eyed and ruminative as a ponderous steer. In Texas, you look at America with a patient eye. You want everything to be sure and slow and set in relation to immense skies and earth that never ends. You wonder why people must talk and strain so much